Thank you. I would just like to welcome the first panel. As promised, we're going to have a very interesting discussion. There are two pieces of good news. The first is that Kevin Hirsch from the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy is here to moderate. He will bring the panel together and maintain discipline. The second piece of good news is that one of the members of the panel who was absent at 5 of 9 is now sitting here, which we find most encouraging. It's called just-in-time delivery. So Kevin, could I turn it over to you? And thank you very much for coming today.
Well, thank you. And it is a pleasure to be here this morning. And on behalf of the White House and the Office of Science and Technology Policy, we'd like to express our appreciation to Chuck and the National Academies for organizing this symposium. It is a critical topic, and we are honored to have with us in the first panel three distinguished guests, leaders of some of the foremost solar PV manufacturers in the world. Before they come up, I'd like to take a couple minutes to highlight some of the new policy directions that President Obama has put in place to take advantage or to advance solar photovoltaics and other renewable energy, other forms of renewable energy. Here's a photo from February of the President and Vice President touring the Denver Science Museum, a rooftop 100 kilowatt solar PV installation. And shortly thereafter, the President released his proposed FY10 budget, which describes several top energy policy priorities. And first is a comprehensive approach to deal with our dependence on oil and climate change and economic considerations through green jobs simultaneously in an integrated way. Second is establishment of a greenhouse gas emissions cap and trade program with the objective to reduce emissions by 80% by 2050. And third is investments of $150 billion over 10 years in development and deployment of clean energy technologies, starting in FY12 using a portion of the revenues from the cap and trade auction. And the President has announced a goal to double renewable energy, non-hydro, renewable power generation by 2012. And this goal is backed up in a very real way with investments in the Recovery Act, the stimulus plan. And this involved several different provisions. First, a grant program in lieu of the tax credits, where that would be beneficial. Expansion of DOE's loan guarantee program. And improvements to the investment tax credit. And establishment of a new manufacturing project credit for solar, PV, and other renewable energy manufacturing. A recent SEIA report has talked about incredible progress that's been made in the solar PV industry, increasing domestic PV production capacity by over 50% just last year, increasing deployment of grid-tied PV by over 50% in 1 year. So we'd like to talk about today and learn how we can continue this pace of improvement. A few more details on the new provisions in the loan guarantee program that were put in the Recovery Act. It appropriated $6 billion to the loan guarantee program, and this now includes covering the credit subsidy costs. And the Recovery Act provided a new aspect of loan guarantees specifically for renewable energy and electric power transmission. And just recently, a couple weeks ago, DOE announced it was offering a loan guarantee to Solyndra for manufacturing of a solar PV manufacturing plant in California. And just to mention the DOE's solar R&D program, which John talked a little bit about, this is a broad-based program which was looking at the full spectrum of opportunities from the long-range R&D all the way to working on pilot production and overcoming supply chain issues and manufacturing issues for market transformation and actually getting these systems out in the field. So I'll just wrap up by a quote from the president's speech yesterday. He was at a wind turbine manufacturer. He said, "America pioneered solar technology, but we've fallen behind countries like Germany and Japan in generating it, even though we've got more sun than either country. I don't accept this is the way it has to be. When it comes to renewable energy, I don't think we should be followers. I think it's time for us to lead." So we look forward to hearing from the speakers this morning and to learn how we can work together to achieve that goal. Our first speaker is Mike Ahern, who is the CEO and chairman of First Solar. His bio is included in the handout. So, Mike.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. This is, I think, part of the awakening in the through the Obama administration and the change in attitude and momentum that is most welcomed by the industry. So it's a pleasure to be here and be asked to speak to you about these topics. Can everybody hear me okay in the back? Okay. Good. Well, I'm going to run through some slides here. We'll skip the forward-looking statement. So First Solar manufactures photovoltaic panels with a thin film semiconductor process. The company started in 1999. It took 6 years to get to what I'd call steady state production with our first manufacturing line. That occurred at the end of 2004. So a laborious, difficult process. But the progress since the end of 2004 has been fairly dramatic. In 2005, which was our first year of production, we made 20 megawatts of solar panels. In 2008, we made a little over 500 megawatts of solar panels. So 2,500% increase over a four-year period. This year, that'll double again to about a gigawatt of annual production capacity. What's particularly relevant, I think, is what happened to manufacturing costs during the course of that scale. And when we got that first line up, our manufacturing costs were about $3 a watt, which is pretty much where the industry stood at that time. Over the ensuing 4 years, the cost reduced by two-thirds, dropping below $1 a watt as of the end of 2008. Now, those trajectories, for reasons I'll describe, are continuing at a fairly steep rate. From an economic development or stimulus point of view, in the course of the scale-up, we invested over $1 billion and created a little over 4,000 direct jobs. If you look at the value chain, it represents tens of thousands of jobs. So this is an example, I think, by any measure, of a fairly significant success story. I would also say this is not unique in the solar industry. This is going on today in varying degrees by a number of solar companies, some of whom are represented here. And it's being driven by the confluence of technology, good solid execution, and good policy emanating for the most part out of Europe. So those are some of the things I want to get a little bit deeper and explain to you, you know, what's happening to allow these kind of results to occur, because I think we can take advantage of some of this learning and maybe skip a few steps that otherwise could chew up a lot of time and money if they're not done right. Let me just start with briefly on the technology. In our case, we load 2-foot by 4-foot sheets of glass robotically onto a conveyor system. These sheets of glass run through a continuous process that takes about 2.5 hours. At the initial step, a very thin film of semiconductor material is deposited. It's about the thickness of a human hair, just to give you an idea. And then it runs through subsequent processing steps. So you'll find variations, I mean, some of you know this, across the material sets and technologies, but that'll give you essentially an idea. It's difficult to get into commercial production with any kind of a thin film technology. But once you're in commercial production, at a minimum level, at a steady state, though, there are very dramatic cost increases and scale improvements available because of the inherent nature of what we're working with here. One lever is the technology potential or roadmap on these kinds of technologies, which is manifested in conversion efficiency. And I'll give you an example. When we started commercial production, our average conversion efficiency, the rate at which sunlight's converted into useful electricity, stood at about 6%. Today, it stands at about 11%. So we've almost doubled it in 4 or 5 years. I think Dick might talk to you about if conversion efficiencies that are almost double that. Once you're in production, there are process improvements and device improvements that can be cycled through. I'm not suggesting this is on the nature of Moore's law. It's not that dramatic, but it's pretty significant. And as you add watt density, as you add more power to a panel, there is no incremental cost in making that panel. So the cost per watt drops precipitously. So that's significant. Anybody that measures cost per watt by today's cost is ignoring a technology trajectory that's very real across these technologies. The second issue has to do with economies of scale. The incremental or variable or marginal cost of producing a photovoltaic panel with technology like ours is minimal because we use very little material, so the material cost is low, and it's automated, so the labor cost is low. On the other hand, the upfront cost, the fixed operating cost and capital is high. So when you're in low production, your average unit cost is going to tend to be fairly high. As you ramp these things and drive volume, that low incremental cost averages your unit cost down at a very rapid rate. So scale economies here are significant. The third lever has to do with productivity. And this is the so-called learning curve effect, cycles of learning that occur. Once you're in a rhythm and you're doing the same things more or less over and over again, you can drive a lot of productivity gain. Now, that gets manifested in our case in greater line throughput to the factories, higher yields, more uptime with the equipment, debottlenecking constraints, and that type of thing, which drives, given the low variable cost, a much lower cost per watt. So you kind of have these three things at work. That productivity piece has been expanded into the supply chain and into factory replication. This shows our factory stack. Each one of these rows represents a factory in our case. And what we've been able to do is move from the ability to begin construction of a new factory every 12 months and ramp that over an 18-month cycle to now beginning construction of a new factory every 3 months and ramping on a cycle that's much shorter than 18 months. In order to do that, you have to bring, obviously, the whole supply chain with you. So you've got to work with your equipment suppliers, your raw material suppliers, in addition to your engineering, procurement, and construction. But what our experience demonstrates, and I think what others have demonstrated in Europe, is the private sector is capable of forming around this and driving these kinds of capacity improvements over time. If we look downstream into the engineering and the procurement and construction of solar generation plants, so moving downstream from the factory, we've seen similar productivity effects here as well. We integrated into the EPC business to build big utility plants in the U.S. because we felt that's the only way we could hit the cost points. It's a much more difficult environment here. And what we've seen through very little, relatively little experience to date, is a rapid improvement in installation time, cycle time through the build of these plants, and a very fast cost reduction. So what underlies, I think, all of this from my perspective and it's absolutely essential, is that you have to have a market. You have to have a market opportunity that will allow you to get commercialized, get in the game, drive cycles of learning, work your technology roadmap, and start to scale from an economic point of view. And this is where First Solar and the solar industry in general, I think, has caught a lucky break, because the European markets, led by Germany, adopted a set of programs in late 2004 that have allowed us to scale and demonstrate these kind of results. Now, this slide, 5.6 gigawatts is an estimate of 2009 market demand. That's not my prediction or First Solar's prediction. It's simply an average of 10 U.S. analysts, the 10 that we think cover this sector most closely. I actually think the U.S. number here is high. I sincerely doubt that the U.S. is going to install 560 megawatts this year. I can't even get close to that, maybe a fourth of that, I mean, to be honest with you. But let's just say we'll be generous here. I think the point this makes, nevertheless, is that the bulk of the solar market is in Europe. The bulk of that European piece is Germany. This is where the industry operates today in a serious way. The rest of the world, you see, that's a fragmented set of markets that include off-grid, remote village power, as well as grid-connected. But these are fragmented small markets that don't allow, in my view, any kind of efficient model. You'll see people dealing with it as an aside, but not present in a real way. Japan is a real market. It's de facto closed to most U.S. companies. As I say, the U.S. has not been a factor for reasons I'll go into. So in Europe, these markets all follow a feed-in tariff. I don't know if you're familiar with it. I'm not necessarily here to pitch a feed-in tariff, but I think it's important to know why do these work? I mean, why do companies go there and why are they gain success? Well, they have national laws that guarantee access to the grid for anybody that buys a solar system and generates solar power. It can be connected. It doesn't have to work through a utility. It doesn't have to get some kind of special permission or go through discretion. It's guaranteed. They set a price, and they oblige the grid operator or the utility to buy the power. So it's very clear you have a market. You can see what the price points are going to be. And these programs typically extend on a multi-year basis. So you know, and your investors know, if you build a factory and you staff up an organization, you're going to have time in the market to recoup that investment and be successful. And they tend to promote fairly uniform markets, so you can make a standardized product and a standardized offering and focus your efforts on scale and cost reduction. So this kind of a program has worked very well for us in the industry. The criticism you get is feed-in tariffs are expensive, and these are massive subsidies and they can't be sustained. It doesn't have to be that way, and that's changing pretty rapidly. If you think about the cost reduction trajectories I mentioned, you can see that feed-in tariffs ought to be able to come down fairly precipitously. This happens to be the First Solar internal roadmap. Other solar companies have similar roadmaps to this. The timing may move around a little bit, but we've had a plan in place now for 4 years to achieve, by 2012, an 8 to 10 cent a kilowatt hour pricing capability. That requires, and this slide basically rolls into it, that requires turnkey installed system costs of somewhere around $2 to $2.50, maybe $2.75 at the high end per watt. Depends on the irradiance and your financing cost assumptions. This is a real plan. I mean, these are trajectories. I threw in a couple of slides that were done back in early 2007 that step our module cost down to the required levels. We're 2 years into this, and we're more than 50% through these milestones. We're on or ahead of every milestone we've set. I know a number of solar companies that can tell you the same thing. It's true on the balance of system. These are detailed bottoms-up plans that are being executed in these European markets to real metrics, and they are being achieved. I'm fairly confident if the market runway, the market opportunity, continues to exist, these trajectories are going to continue and we're going to hit the targets. And I think you'll see as silicon feedstock shortages abate in China, some fairly startling numbers coming out of there as well. So be aware there's a lot of momentum moving right now outside the U.S. As you turn to the U.S., you know, I think this is a good time to be realistic and fairly candid about where we are and where we aren't. I mean, you can look at some aggregate numbers and talk about a 50% increase, but the fact is that's off of a minuscule base. The U.S. Has had, I think, what you'd have to call minimal solar manufacturing. The solar manufacturers that are based here, like us and like SunPower, put the bulk of our manufacturing outside the U.S. for reasons I'll describe, not by choice. I mean, believe me, it's quite the contrary. But the market opportunity here has been fragmented and sporadic at best. They have not been the kind of markets where you can scale a technology or run an efficient business. So there really hasn't been a lot of choice. And what's interesting is, at least it was to me, if you look at the level of state programs, at least the number of state programs and the 30% ITC, that looks like a fair amount of support. I mean, it doesn't look like we're starving the subsidy market here, and yet we're not getting a very good result. I think it has to do with the structure and the way these programs are put together, which I'll talk about here briefly. Despite the traction in Europe, I think it's early relative to where the industry's heading. If we're talking about a low-carbon market, there's a massive opportunity. We're still in the early stage. There's plenty of opportunity for the U.S. to take the lead here. And in fact, I think the timing's right because we can benefit from lessons learned and cost reductions that have occurred in Europe. So I think the discussion should start with a big picture here. On the left, you see the demand slide I showed you. On the right is same analyst, same estimate of manufacturing capacity existing at year-end 2009. Now, this may be a little bit inflated in the sense that it's capacity, not actual production. Not all those plants are going to be fully utilized. And it's a number that comes at the end of the year. But I think the basic message here is right. There's a lot more manufacturing capacity in the world today than there is demand. And absent some kind of a change, that's not going to correct itself. So right from the start, you'd have to conclude that policies directed to increasing manufacturing capacity, if they don't deal with market demand, are not going to drive any kind of sustainable activity that's relevant. That market demand doesn't increase by itself. That takes subsidies, market incentives, and the existing markets that exist off this handful of European countries cannot grow at an exponential rate or even a meaningful compound annual rate because the burden on ratepayers or taxpayers won't sustain it. So you can't ignore this problem and work the capacity without thinking about demand. The other thing I think that jumps off of this slide is China. Polycrystalline silicon production has become commoditized. Entry barriers now are low or non-existent. Anybody in this room that wants to get into manufacturing of polycrystalline silicon can do that today. We can buy turnkey lines. We can get people to install them and train us. We can operate these things. So what that means is if you're talking about polycrystalline silicon manufacturing and you want to be competitive going forward, I think you have to be in China or some kind of a low-cost country to have a shot at this right off the bat. Now, technology-driven solutions, high-efficiency monocrystalline silicon as an example. Dick will probably talk about that with SunPower. Thin film, organics, flex substrate, that's a different story. And then that's where manufacturers like us have a choice to make in terms of where we put the manufacturing. There are two places to put it from my perspective. One is you go where the markets are, because you want to signal to the politicians that have made the investment in creating a market that they're getting the desired payback in the form of investment and economic value add. So you go to those markets. And you also find increasingly in markets like Germany, there's a core set of human skills and technology and resource that is sensible for you to locate there. So you either go there or you go to a low-cost environment that has the kind of IP production and infrastructure, manufacturing infrastructure, that will support you. But it's much less of a factor for the kind of technologies that we work with, because the labor content's fairly low. So I think the opportunity here for the U.S. is around higher technology-oriented solutions, and I think to have a shot, we have to create a market that will attract us. Otherwise, you tend to go where the markets exist. In thinking about that, I think we should adopt a page here from Europe and start with the end in mind and say, look, at the end of the day, if we're really going to get to a low-carbon infrastructure and come down 50% below 1990 levels or anything close, we're going to need a whole basket of solutions ranging from renewable energy to energy efficiency. We're going to need carbon pricing in place, fully implemented, that sets the right market signal, and all kinds of infrastructure around that. And if you start to work backwards to get to that, one thing we'll need is scaled technologies, each technology working at its economic potential. And not all technologies are situated similarly. So if you take wind, onshore wind, that's a scaled technology today. It's 30 years of scale, mostly under feed-in tariff programs, that have brought costs down by 80%. Solar is very early in that scale. There are other technologies we're going to need that haven't even been commercialized. So what Europe does that is essential is they take a sectoral approach to these things and say, where are each of these technologies along this scale? And what do we need to do to get this technology, let's take photovoltaics, to commercial scale? If you create a one-size-fits-all, let's take a national RPS and say, here's a quota system, we're going to let the market sort this out, then the market's going to do what that program's designed to do. It's going to go to the least cost solution today. And if that's the policy goal, it might work. I think it still has some problem. But if the policy goal is to scale up a number of technologies we're going to need for the stretch run, it clearly won't work. I mean, by design, it's not intended to do that. So I think right away, focusing on the sectors, and we're going to have to get our hands a little dirtier here, to think about how to get the right result. But that's what we'd suggest as a basic framework. Now, solar is on the left hand of that scale today. So R&D, commercialization, and scale up, I think, are the issues. And if you think about R&D, I mean, we need a set of commercially viable technologies driven by fundamental R&D, obviously applied R&D that eventually manifests itself in existence proofs, alpha products, concept lines, a set of outcomes that suggest here's some technology that has commercial potential. We can put together a scenario, cause and effect, in our minds of how this technology moves from lab scale to something that will be compelling in the marketplace and how it can scale. That's what we need. Now, the U.S., I think, has done a pretty good job here. I mean, if you look at the technologies that have come out of U.S. universities and labs and are present globally in solar, it's pretty impressive. NREL, I think Ken Zweibel will be here later today, through the Thin Film Partnership, was instrumental in our technology developing. So there is a key role, I think, for the federal government to fund basic science, fundamental research and development, through universities, national labs, and consortia, to keep the flow of commercially viable technologies moving across a number of fronts, which we can get into. At some point, though, as those become interesting and ready to put into operation, you need to move to the next stage of commercialization, where you have to have entrepreneurial activity and risk capital. Those are the strong suits of the U.S. I mean, traditionally. We're real good at raising and putting venture capital to work, and we've got a great entrepreneurial base of talent here. What's needed to galvanize all that is a compelling market opportunity. And if you think about the last several years, there have been several billion dollars of venture capital formed and hundreds of startups in PV. it's all off the market opportunity or the prospect of that in Europe. That's what these guys are doing. And what they're planning to do, most of them, is if they get into production, they're planning to move over to Europe to start taking advantage and send a signal to the politicians to keep going. So this commercialization piece, I think, is where it becomes very important to put a U.S. market opportunity out there in a transparent way so people can see what's possible if they risk capital. This is also a segment where I think we should, the government ought to be operating on a non-selective basis. I think when you start to pick winners here and you start to pick company A and say, here's $500 million of aid, or a group of companies under the SAI program and say, you're the ones we're going to give a bunch of money to go get to low cost, I think you run some real risks. I mean, one risk is you're going to be wrong and that money's not going to come to fruition. This whole category of commercialization is high risk. I mean, the probabilities are most of them aren't going to work. So if you're picking winners with taxpayer dollars, it's probably not going to work statistically. It's an area where the private sector will engage, so public money is not necessary once you have commercially viable technology and a solid opportunity. And it's an area where if you do select companies, you're biasing the market here. You're distorting the market. You have a lot of other companies that have to live by the normal rules, and if they fail, they go away. And you're allowing some to exist while others don't get that right and privilege. And you're sending signals that perhaps there's a government sponsorship around certain types of technologies. So I think most importantly, if we provide selective kind of benefits to the exclusion of creating a real market opportunity, you're leaving a lot of companies on the sidelines that could be jumping in with private sector money to do some good here. The scale-up piece is that's the mode we're in now, and a lot of other companies. As you come through this and you get that first line working and the product's vetted, this is all about scale. And to scale, you got to access the capital markets. These are capital intensive, so we have to put, you're talking about billions of dollars that has to get put to work. We have well-formed capital markets in the U.S., leaving the current issues aside. This is something we're pretty good at. We've got a lot of companies in adjacent business industries, semiconductor industries and otherwise, that know how to get this done. Even a startup like us could recruit the talent and adopt the tools to get to scale. What's critical is a market that will repay investment and give some visibility to investors. So I would urge you to think about that. This is also not a place for selective subsidies, if you will. And the issue, I think, with this loan guarantee program, if you all follow along the loan guarantee program, I think we'll illustrate the point that we're going to see a big logjam now and a very difficult period trying to raise project finance to get projects done because you have to work through a selective process with no visibility through the DOE. And I think we'd be much better off if the government did something prophylactically that enabled all banks to make loans that the market would drive. So these are, I think you can, I don't know if people are going to have access to these slides, probably go through the rest of it more quickly, but my point is that we ought to be focused in solar right now on commercialization and scale, creating markets that will attract investment.
Go ahead and move to.
Yeah. And then I think if you go back to the feed-in tariffs and look for a minute at what they've done to enable these markets, I think it starts to give you the clues for where we need to go in the U.S.
Okay, and our next speaker, thank you very much, Mike, very enlightening. Our next speaker is Dick Swanson, who is the president, CTO, and co-founder of SunPower.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank the National Academies for putting this workshop together, and I'd like to thank Mike for a great talk, and I think very insightful. In my presentation, I'm going to give you a very short overview of SunPower, in case you haven't really followed the SunPower story, and then walk you through the value chain carefully so that everyone understands really where the manufacturing is going on currently in the world. Safe harbor statement. By the way, we're having our earnings release today, so you're welcome to tune into that later. SunPower was formed in 1985 to develop technology developed at Stanford University. That technology program was funded largely by the Electric Power Research Institute and the U.S. Department of Energy. initial concept for our market was what are called concentrating systems today, large dishes in the desert, focusing light on special high-performance solar cells in the form of what we called solar farms back then. That market didn't happen. SunPower sort of wandered in the woods for a long time building specialty products, high-performance solar cells, culminating eventually in a solar-powered airplane for NASA, which set an altitude record. And so if you'd ask people in the industry in the 90s about SunPower, the image was, well, it's sort of a boutique high-performance cell manufacturer, but not really of any commercial importance. The big break for SunPower came in 2000 when we merged with Cypress Semiconductor. Merge is a bit of a euphemism here, but technically that's what we did. Cypress really bought our vision that PV was going to be a large-scale enterprise, and they had the manufacturing know-how to inject our technology with the juice it needed to really take off. That partnership proved extremely beneficial, and I think today PV is really a manufacturing-oriented business where operational excellence is going to be a major distinguishing feature between successful companies and not successful companies. We opened our first manufacturing line in the Philippines, and then we decided to start moving downstream. We merged again with PowerLight Corporation, which was the largest system integrator in the world at that time, and began installing power plants on the roofs of commercial buildings and in large fields. Today, we're a pretty global company with offices all over the world, manufacturing in many places around the world. We did about $1.4 billion last year in revenue, and we're the ninth largest company in the photovoltaic sector based on megawatts produced. We've now gotten into all of the main market sectors in PV. The residential retrofit market on the upper left, that's people that put panels on their roof. That's a rapidly growing market in the United States. People also put PV on the roofs of commercial buildings, and that's a rapidly growing market. In the lower left, that's a picture of the Microsoft campus in San Jose, Mountain View, California, with SunPower arrays on it. We also are working with new home builders to put PV into a roof where it's actually part of the roof. And this gets around one of the issues that's commonly brought forth for the residential market, and that is PV panels are basically ugly. So if you can integrate them into the roof, the customer acceptance is dramatically larger, and this market is actually our fastest-growing market segment as new home builders incorporate this as a selling feature in their home project. And then finally, there's the large ground-mounted power plants, which was really the original vision for photovoltaics when people got into this in the 1970s. Actually, what happened was, though, the United States was by far the leader. If you go back to the 1980s, essentially all photovoltaics were built in the United States, and we were the largest market by far. Then it moved to Japan when the killer app was found, if you will. That's putting PV on people's roofs and directly grid connecting them right there. Japan became the largest market, and the center of gravity moved to Japan. Then Europe started the feed-in tariff that Michael was talking about, and that drove the second great wave of expansion, leaving the U.S. somewhat in the dust, if you will. But I think The basic message is that the manufacturing and the technology follows the markets. If we want to have, and the basic message of my presentation is going to be, if you want manufacturing in the United States, you have to be a market leader in the United States. This is just some pictures of what these things kind of look like. I'll go through this real fast, except for this one, of course, which is our array on the Forrestal Building here in Washington, D.C. So this is a good example of a flat roof building integrated array. This is an example of a ground-mounted PV array that's powering Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. These particular units track the sun from sunrise to sunset. So let's talk about the value chain here. The crystalline silicon and polycrystalline silicon industry has a fairly complicated value chain, especially compared to the thin film, but it's useful to look at it. We start with highly refined silicon. We call that polysilicon. We grow ingots out of it. Okay, that's big single crystals in our case. We slice those ingots into wafers. We then turn those wafers into solar cells. We laminate those solar cells behind panels. And finally, we install them on a system. Now, if you look at the costs through this value chain, you can see that actually 50% of the cost is really in the installation. Now, this is a bit out of date, and this is in particular for a residential application. But it's important to note that the installation of a PV system is a very expensive proposition and involves, of course, local manufacturing and labor where it's actually installed. The actual polysilicon and ingot is maybe 20%, and the solar cell manufacturing and converting it into a panel is maybe 30%. So in preparing for this talk, I got together with our operations people and said, gee, what is the real U.S. content that we're looking at in this value chain right here today for SunPower? And so we went through this and meticulously calculated it, and the answer just knocked my socks off. Basically, the U.S. content for a SunPower module, even though it's made in the Philippines, is 70%. And I'm going to step you through where these contributions come from. But I think it's a surprising result. It was a pleasing result to me. And it's illustrative of the fact that you really don't want to focus on exactly where the cell is made necessarily. That is not where all the value is necessarily. And, of course, the installation is essentially all U.S. if the system is installed in the U.S. So let's start with the polysilicon, which is our largest single cost element. We buy polysilicon from Hemlock Corporation in Michigan. Okay, this is a picture of their plant. These things are hugely capital intensive. And despite the fact that there's been numerous startups in China and elsewhere trying to get into the polysilicon production because demand has increased so fast, still the preponderance of it is actually in the United States. We buy from a number of manufacturers. This shows who makes polysilicon. We've got Hemlock, Renewable Energy Corporation, REC in Montana. Oh, it's a Norwegian company, but it's made in Montana. MEMC, another U.S. company. Polysilicon's made in Texas. The only companies on this list that we buy polysilicon from that are not U.S.-based companies are Wacker in Germany, DCC in Korea, and MSETEC in Japan, a new entrance into this field. So if you take our polysilicon production, that's part of the value chain. Polysilicon, however, is basically an equipment business. It's just buying giant, large machines that make and refine the polysilicon. DC Chemical, for example, DCC in Korea, who we do buy polysilicon from, buys their equipment from GT Solar in the United States. Okay. Let's move on to ingot growth. This is a picture of our joint venture in Korea where we grow the single crystal ingots. We get maybe half of our ingots from this joint venture. The rest we buy from a number of other people. shown here on this list. Here we're a little bit short on U.S. suppliers of ingot growth. On the other hand, the growers themselves, and this is once again a very capital intensive, a lot of them come from the United States. Going to the wafer, that's kind of a dirty, fairly labor intensive operation. We are doing it in a number of places. On the other hand, the equipment for this slicing, much of it comes from Applied Materials, a U.S. Company, and Meyer Burger, a Swiss company. Now, look at the labor content here. For slicing the wafer, there's something like 75 to 100 people are required to operate that factory per 100 megawatts of capacity, of production capacity. If we go back to the ingot, the labor content here is maybe 25 to 50 people per 100 megawatts. So keep that in the back of your mind as we go through where the labor actually is. Not much in growing ingot. In fact, it's pretty clear looking at this picture. There is nobody standing around. This factory runs 12 growers per operator. One operator is responsible for caretaking 12 of those machines. The sawing is a little bit more labor intensive. Then let's go to the solar cell. This is a picture of our second factory in the Philippines. It looks a bit like a semiconductor fab. And our manufacturing is in the Philippines. That SPML stands for SunPower Manila Limited. Second factory we're building is in Malaysia. Let's look again at the equipment suppliers. U.S., 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 U.S. A lot of this equipment comes from U.S. Now, if we were to go back to 1980, as I said, almost all of the PV was manufactured in the U.S. and almost all the equipment was manufactured in the U.S. The fact that we're still 70% U.S. content through the panel, I think, is remarkable. That's the good news. It would have been 100% 20 years ago. But that number is rapidly decreasing. So the issue is how can we sort of stem the tide towards non-U.S. Sources here. One of the ways that we're doing that is what we call a auto line. This is taking the cells now that have been made, in our case in Manila, and laminating the behind glass. Okay, to do this in a cost-effective way in outside of China requires that the line be very highly automated. So we are currently under our SAI contract developing a highly automated assembly line that takes cells, laminates them behind glass. We expect, this is normally a very labor-intensive operation, we expect to get the labor content down to about 150 to 300 people per 100 megawatts of capacity with these auto lines. We're very excited about these auto lines for a number of reasons, but let's take a look at our idea here. Basically, we're working with contract manufacturers to build and operate these lines in regions where there's local markets that can justify it, and that's about 100 megawatts. It takes a local market of about 100 megawatts to justify putting the local assembly in the auto line in there. All the equipment in this auto line comes from the U.S. All the significant pieces of equipment come from the U.S. And the labor content is about 200 to 300 people per megawatt, 100 megawatt production capacity. The advantages of this that we see, this is all about rationalizing the logistics chain, which is becoming a significant part of the overall cost in photovoltaics today. It reduces glass shipping cost. Today we buy glass in the United States, we ship it to China to get turned into a module, then we ship it to Germany to be installed. That is 95% of the weight of the finished product. Doesn't make sense to be sending that glass all over the world. In the future, we'll ship the glass right to the ModCo, Module Assembly Company, and they will make it into a panel, and it will then take the short drive to the local site. So it reduces the shipping cost of the module thereby. It reduces the cycle time so that we can respond to customer changes in demand very quickly. Is it power plant modules? Is it rooftop modules? Is it roof shingles? The line can shift, and we don't have months of inventory tied up on ships. And, of course, that reduces the dollars tied up in inventory and that sort of thing. Also, we want to standardize these so we can bring the cost down as we plop these identical modcos around the world. System integration, the final point, of course, is by nature very local sort of activity, also consumes quite a bit of labor. Right now, about 250 people per 100 megawatts per year manufacturing. So you can scale these numbers up and down depending on what kind of market we expect to see in the United States to see what the labor content would be. But it takes a lot of skills to build these power plants, a lot of different types of manufacturing. One of the things we're doing with the power plants is we're building local assembly sites after the module manufacturing. So for the power plants, the panels have to be arrayed on a tracking structure, and that's sort of a factory type of operation. So we're doing that now in local factories. This is one in Spain in this picture, because that's where most of the power plants went last year. But you can see that the modules have been assembled on trackers ready for shipment to the field. We're also working on low-cost ways of installing the systems in the field. This is a picture of a system going in where the foundations are not drilled into the ground and filled with concrete, which was the normal procedure in the past for building PV plants, but just concrete pads that are plopped down over the surface of the ground. This can be very rapid. You avoid the problems with hitting rocks and that sort of thing that plagued PV site installation in the past. And as a result of that, we've vastly been able to increase the rate at which one crew can install a PV plant. In Spain, towards the end of our production last year, we were doing 2 megawatts per day per crew. Okay, so think about it. That's pretty serious. That's 3/4 of a gigawatt per year for one crew, essentially building a large power plant in 1 year. You couldn't even permit most power plants inside of a year. And the industry is ready to scale to build them that quickly. So with that, I'll thank you very much, and I hope it's been helpful.
Thank you, Dick. Excellent. And our third speaker on the first panel is Eric Peters. Eric is Global Executive Director of Dow Corning Solar Solutions.
Thank you, and thank you to the National Academy of Sciences and DOE for kindly inviting Dow Corning to the table. What you will see is that Dow Corning actually plays a very different role in the solar value chain than the two companies that were represented before. Dow Corning is essentially a raw material supplier into this industry. Our name appeared a couple of times in the slides from SunPower. And what I will do today is I will give you a very brief overview of who we are so you can kind of position us in this industry and then talk about PV manufacturing in the U.S. So basically, Dow Corning as a corporation, we are an American company. We're a joint venture between Dow Chemical and Corning. And we have been a joint venture for a long, long time. We've been around since 1943. And essentially, if you would use modern terminology, we started up as a technology startup to develop the world of silicon chemistry. And that is basically what we still do today. So everything we do is based on the silicon atom. And that silicon atom plays an essential role in the solar PV industry, either as a semiconductor material, the polysilicon we talked about, or as a material that is used in other parts in the value chain. You kind of see the size of our company. Last year we were a $5.5 billion company, and we employ about 10,000 people, and we employ them really worldwide. As an approximation, we have about 1/3 of our turnover in the U.S., 1/3 in Europe, and 1/3 in Asia. You also see that we are quite heavy on R&D, and which is kind of unique in the chemical industry, this higher number. We see ourselves as a material house to the PV solar industry. The reason is, as I said before, polysilicon is a very important feedstock material. silane, monosilane is going to be an important feedstock material for amorphous silicon thin film panels. And in addition to that, there is a really good fit between silicones in general, the kind of materials that are also used in the construction industry and the electronics industry, etc., to enable the solar PV market to be efficient, basically. Our materials really help to lower the cost, help to improve the efficiency, help to improve some of the manufacturing challenges. We've invested a lot in the solar industry. Polysilicon was mentioned a couple of times before. Polysilicon is very capital intensive. The Hemlock Semiconductor Company that you saw a picture of our Michigan site before is owned by Dow Corning. We are the majority owner, and you see some of the numbers there. I mean, the investments are in the multiple billions of dollars. It requires a lot of expertise, and interestingly, if you add up all the comments made this morning, we did choose to put all of that manufacturing in the U.S. One of the main reasons why we're actually doing that is because there's quite a lot of high tech involved. There is a lot of trade secrets here. We want to protect our IP. That's one reason. The other reason is we have some huge integration benefits with our silicone plants. And that is actually helping us to have a world-class cost structure here. It is very automated. It's really like a chemical plant, so the labor cost component is fairly low. And as I said, the advantages of integrating, and we talk about closed-loop processing, having all the byproducts recycled, that is really important in polysilicon manufacturing. But you also see that we are making some other investments, mainly in R&D application centers, etc. So what are the big opportunities and challenges for manufacturing PV in the US? And although we are a raw material supplier into this industry, you will see that a lot of the themes are coming back here from the previous two presentations. The fundamental challenge for solar PV or any other alternative energy technology, we should never forget, is about reducing the cost of the energy per kilowatt hour. Because clearly, yes, this industry needs some form of subsidizing. Yes, this industry needs help from governments to grow and to grow beyond its infancy. But clearly, that cannot be the future. The future has to be that this industry can be self-sustained, which basically means needs to be able to provide energy at an affordable cost without requirement of subsidizing. So what SunPower or First Solar or Dow Corning or any other company in this field is really working on is on the technology roadmaps that allow us to reduce costs sufficiently so that on a per kilowatt hour base, you know, we can be competitive. And I think the number that was mentioned by First Solar is like 10 cents per kilowatt hour or below that, and I really believe that that's where, you know, this industry has to get to. So if you split that, how can you actually reduce the cost per kilowatt hour? Very, very importantly, and again, it was mentioned before, innovation is really essential here. This is about technology innovation. This is about technology innovation, not just in the mainstream crystalline type of PV industry, that although we have an important position there in Hemlock, I mean, we believe that there is room for other technologies as well. Definitely, this is a big market. It's going to segment into different needs. So the innovation is needed in the kind of traditional technology, but also the innovation in terms of alternative technologies, thin film technologies, and even non-photovoltaic technologies is really important. So I expect there is going to be a significant diversification continuing to go on in terms of technologies, and that most of those technologies will be able to coexist for a quite a long period going into the future. This was mentioned before as well. A very, very important factor to get cost out is around operational excellence and economy of scale. And clearly, this requires a lot of capital, and the private sector is investing in this. It's about automation, it's about high-yield processing. It's not just about the yield of the solar cell or the module, but it's also about the yield of manufacturing. It is about reducing the capital intensity. It is about improving the labor efficiency, especially in the U.S. That's going to be extremely critical to improve the labor efficiency to create a domestic manufacturing market. So the innovation is not just at the technical kind of, you know, chemistry or electronics level, but it's also really important in manufacturing. very, very important factor as well as raw material conversion efficiency. There is not so much discussion about that usually in these kind of forums, but the reality is, and this is my personal perspective, is that the solar industry is actually very young and very immature, which actually means there is a huge amount of inefficiencies. If you look at this value chain that Dick presented, it's not all perfect, and not in all of these steps there is 100% yield. And I will give one example. For instance, the step where you take one of these ingots and you slice it into wafers, actually 50% of the material is lost when we do that, because these wafers are so thin that the saw that you use to slice them is actually becoming relatively thick in comparison to the thickness of the wafer. So there is a lot of losses there, and I think that is true throughout the value chain, that there is still significant improvement that the industry can make, and you know, together with I think the innovation component and academia are going to come into that as well. So we clearly have to reduce the number of raw materials that are used per watt peak, and I can share a number with you to show that the industry is actually doing that. Maybe 5-6 years ago, before this big, you know, boom was happening, most people would use something like 10 to 12 grams of polysilicon for 1 watt peak. I think today that's down to maybe 7 to 8 for some players, and I think the people that are the lowest in usage are maybe down below 6. So that is a significant improvement from 12 grams to 6, and the roadmap is only going to take that down over time. So the industry is becoming more efficient in the raw material uses, but clearly there is still a long way to go. Also very important is durability, and that is an outstanding way to get cost out. This industry is talking a lot about efficiencies per watt peak. That's kind of nice, and it's a little bit theoretical. It's in lab conditions where you measure that, and you look at basically the theoretical efficiency. What is really important is how many kilowatt hours can you get out of a panel over the lifetime of the panel. How do you improve that? Well, you can do all this nice innovation and everything I talked about to increase the cell efficiency. But one of the most important things you can do is to make sure that a module lives longer. So today the standard in this industry is that a module is kind of guaranteed for 20 years at 80% of the power output, maybe 25 in some cases. The future is to make that into 30 years and 40 years and not have 80% of the power output, but 95 or 90. And again, innovation across the value chain in terms of materials and production technologies, and all of that coming together is going to be really essential and is going to help the industry to get there. So if these are kind of the four pillars of how this industry is going to be successful in reducing cost, I'm now going to try to apply that a little bit to manufacturing. What does that mean from a manufacturing perspective? I think manufacturing cannot stand alone. So absolutely critical for successful PV manufacturing in the US is that manufacturing is backed up by world-class innovation. And I think world-class innovation, some of that happens in the industry, but really, really important is also the academic world, where there is some fundamental research going on, but I also think it's really important that the research is applied and that there is strong collaboration between academia and industry. And I'm actually really pleased to see that IMEC is here today and is going to present, not just because I'm a Belgian, but basically, I mean, IMEC is a really good example of how to do this successfully. And we talked a lot about how big the market is in Europe and why Europe is so successful. And clearly, policy making and feed-in tariffs and these kind of things have helped a lot. But the other thing which has helped a lot, I think, are the research institutes in Europe. Institutes like IMEC and Fraunhofer and a few others have really helped to develop this industry. And a lot of the products that we see in the market, the innovation has actually come from institutes like that, you know, and in addition, of course, NREL and some other places around the world, for instance, in Japan. Also very important is that the industry, you know, has to work together. And I think we're doing that. The natural market mechanisms are helping for that. But I think in addition to that, I think there is room here for government to provide some more infrastructure for that. A solar panel essentially is a system, and it's a system, you know, with different components. And if we want to do innovation and really dramatically improve the performance of that system, that means that every single element of that system has to be improved. And they can't just be improved on their own, because we will have something that is sub-optimized. So it's important that to get this innovation go through, that there is cross-industry collaboration along this whole value chain, so that if somebody comes up with a great new glass technology, that actually somebody else has come up with a way to assemble that glass into a panel and that it can actually be installed in the market, as an example. So there is room for a lot of collaboration there. And I think DOE and some of the funding that is going on can actually help stimulate some of that research going in the right direction. And I would agree with one of the previous speakers that that has to be really technology agnostic. It's important, I think, not to kind of try to pick the winners when it's too early, but to try to stimulate the, you know, the, all the different ways that are there, because this industry probably for a long time will need some pretty creative solutions. Investment is also needed to achieve world-class manufacturing standards, and this goes together. Especially the U.S. will need world-class manufacturing standards in terms of the degree of automation, etc. But this also goes together with quality standards for the end product, for the at the module level. PV, again, is a very young industry, so essentially there are no real industry standards for this industry. The standards are adopted from other industries, either from the electronics industry or from the semiconductor industry or at the installation level, sometimes from the construction industry. I think there is still a lot of work to do to align those things and to basically ensure that when somebody installs a solar panel on their roof that they get the right quality. And this has been a very attractive opportunity for many, many companies to play. And some of those companies, and for sure the two companies here today are like that, are playing at, you know, very high quality products and have a very good reputation. There has also been a lot of companies just coming into this market with low quality, especially from China. And the industry, and I, again, together with government, they have to come together to some level regulate this market in terms of norms and quality standards. So that basically that kind of problem is avoided. Also extremely important, and it is very important, I think, at the manufacturing level, is that it requires technical talent to run those plants at the different points in the value chain and also at the installation. I think we talked a lot about the pure manufacturing here today, so I'm not going to elaborate too much on that. But one of the bottlenecks that I see could happen in the U.S. and in other countries that are starting with solar is that there is also labor required at the installation level. And today, when installations start in a country, installations are done kind of by, you know, many, many different people, especially at the residential level. And again, there is room for improvement there to make sure that, you know, we educate the right level of talent, we develop that workforce through the value chain from the factory all the way to the installation. And then I kept this as last, and it is the most important point, and it definitely concurs with the previous talkers as well. This industry is not going to, I will start that sentence differently. It is going to be impossible to create a flourishing US-based manufacturing PV industry if there is no domestic demand. Domestic demand is essential. It's really important to stimulate demand, and it is all the types of demand that SunPower talked about, from residential all the way to utility scale. That is essential, and I think it is actually, in my opinion, not so difficult to do, and probably Europe is an example of how to do it. And there is, I will give a very small example from my home country. I mean, Belgium is very small, 10 million people. And actually, if you look at a map with hours of sunlight, you will realize pretty quickly that it's kind of this dark green spot, so there is not much sunlight. Actually, every single state of the 51 contingent states in North America are better sunlight conditions than Belgium, every single one, even Michigan. Okay? And yet, in Belgium, a system was put in place which is a combination of a tax incentive for the investment at residential level with a system of green certificates and net metering, basically a meter that can run in two directions. That was put in place, and my number, and I think I'm right, is that the market last year was close to 50 megawatts, 48, I think. 50 megawatts doesn't sound very big if you listen to some of the gigawatt numbers, but if you prorate that per capita on the US scale, that would generate a market of 1.5 to 2 gigawatts in 12 months. So it is possible, and actually the U.S. should do much better than that if you look at the sunlight conditions. So, and this is my last slide, I think. What can the government do? Where would we like to see some of the attention? Clearly, it is really important to stimulate demand, and that is what the first bullet there is about. And whether that is any of those things that are there, whether it's a feed-in tariff or something else, or however we call it, I think it is important that the incentives are placed to stimulate the investment, to make sure that people can connect to the grid, to make sure that the grid works well. There is a lot of work to do there in the U.S. in terms of grid infrastructure. And basically to put the renewable energy standards in place that are going to allow this industry to grow. That is really essential. We believe that R&D is really essential. I talked a lot about innovation, and I think this is an area for investment in the private sector, but also in the public sector and working together. Supporting education and training of people that are going to end up having those green jobs, I think that's essential. And I also think, and that's the last point, that the federal government can play a role as a leading user of green energy. And we've seen some examples on the SunPower slides where it's basically kind of government-owned installations. And more of that can be done as well. So basically that is what I had to show. Hopefully I didn't bore you too much with a different perspective of a company that is not actually making PV modules, but I think plays an essential role in this industry. And I was interested to see that the perspective from the three speakers this morning was actually quite similar. Thank you.
A few minutes for questions.
I have time for just a couple questions before I break. And please say your name and keep it brief, please.
My name is, can you hear me? Roger Little, and I'm the CEO of Spire Corporation. And we've been in this business longer than any other company on Earth. Some of our customers are Dow Corning and First Solar. And I wanted to say that right now the U.S. is on the brink of becoming the fastest growing market for PV in the world. I don't think there's any question about it with the stimulus bill, the state initiatives going on. And if you look at the market projections, the market will be on the order of 5 gigawatts in 3 years, which is equal to today's market in the world. That market will be filled principally by today's technology of crystalline silicon. 80 to 90% of it will be crystalline silicon. The manufacturing capability in the U.S. today for crystalline silicon modules is a few hundred megawatts. There's a huge suction, and what we're going to do if we continue on our path is we're going to create 10,000 Chinese jobs. That's what Spain did. They created 8,000 Chinese jobs. So my point is this. Now is the time to, when we put these initiatives in, the stimulus bill and my friends from DOE and so forth, let's have a Buy American clause in there so we can get a chance to build our own domestic industry. We don't mind that people come from Europe and establish factories or from China and establish factories. But if we start importing all the modules that are going to be required in the year 2012, we're going to totally obliterate domestic manufacturing. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. Do you have a question?
I just have a statement or maybe a question.
One question. Yeah, okay. I think we're looking for questions.
Okay, let me ask a question then.
Okay.
My name is Yao Obin and I work for NIST, but I'm speaking on my own behalf, not on the behalf of NIST. I want to push back on the statement that Mike from First Solar made, the argument that when it comes to commercialization, the government should step back and let the private take over. From my own personal experience, that doesn't work very well, because my experiences with VCs, as an entrepreneur, as a person who started up two companies, the VCs would take technology that they don't understand and run into the sandbar because of the need for quick turnaround or quick bucks. Okay, a lot of innovative technologies die on the grapevine because the VCs get involved. So I think there's room for both VCs and the public investment in the commercialization. What does he think about that statement?
That's the question. Well, I guess my bias goes the other way on that. I mean, I didn't have a successful result with the public investment, or the VCs can't be arbitrary. I used to be one, and so I'm a little bit biased. But yeah, I think that's a fair comment. But I still think that if the market opportunity is clear, I mean, we ought to be thinking about is what does it take for GE or Dow or SunPower or First Solar or the big companies that are going to make a difference here? What does it take for them to be all in and build that capacity rapidly and invest in the value chain? I mean, what does it really take to get the top talent and the top money in fast and big? I think what it takes is the carrot. You know, it basically, if you do this and successful, here's the market result that you get. And I think if we can solve that, and I definitely agree about continuing to invest in fundamental R&D and collaborations. We've been a big beneficiary of technology that was created, and it's a strong suit of the U.S. And I would hate to, and I also agree with the comment that is occurring broadly in Europe through a number of state-sponsored initiatives. You would hate to lose that. So it just feels to me like a strong push at the fundamental level and a big attractive market will really catalyze this thing. And the other thing about doing this selectively, it takes a lot of time. I mean, to evaluate one company's application and make that kind of investment, it chews up a lot of time and effort on the public sector side, and the marketplace can move a lot faster. And I do think speed is essential. And if you look at China and how rapidly they built this capacity, it's shocking. I mean, it's not shocking if you see what they've done in other sectors, but this is ongoing. It's continuing, you know, as we sit here today. So we're going to need something that can move quickly and smartly, and usually getting that to the market force level, I think, works best.